Hello all, welcome back to the second episode of Juan's segment on the TFHP podcast. So on the previous episode, I said that the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine was, in my opinion, the most promising one, and guess what? Voila, right? It was the first vaccine ever for the coronavirus to easily clear the 50% efficacy requirement from the FDA with a 90% efficacy from its phase 3 trial results, which was later revised to 95%. 95% is, let's just say it's incredibly high for a vaccine, like unbelievably high, better than the flu vaccine. And also it's remarkable considering that this vaccine was developed in less than a year. It also has reported to have no major side effects, which means that it's probably, most likely, going to be approved by the FDA any moment now. As a side note, right, Moderna, which I also mentioned in the last episode, released its vaccine data from its phase 3 trial results just a little bit later than Pfizer and reported a 94.5% efficacy. So that's pretty incredibly high. I mean, it's good news, right? What's worthy of note of these companies is that they're both developing like a different type of vaccine than what usually vaccines are, right? So usually normal vaccines, like not these ones, but they're made out of decapacitated viruses, which these don't use. They use mRNA, right? I went in more depth in my previous episode if you want more info on this. A thing to note is that Moderna has never in its entire history made a vaccine approved by the FDA. This is because it specializes in making these mRNA vaccines, and mRNA vaccines are quite new to science compared to other vaccines, right? Pfizer, on the other hand, has been around since the 1800s and has developed hundreds of drugs such as Viagra and Advil, which are, I guess, one of their more famous ones, or notorious, or just well-known ones. And they're a much larger company than Moderna. It doesn't mean the Moderna vaccine is better or worse than the Pfizer vaccine. It's just me comparing the two companies. I mean, chances are more people will get the Pfizer vaccine if both vaccines get approved from the FDA. Moderna simply doesn't have enough doses to compare with Pfizer. So Moderna has plans to ship 20 million doses by the end of the year, while Pfizer already has produced the vaccine anticipating its FDA approval. I mean, not only that, but it plans to ship 100 million doses of its vaccine by the end of the year, which is 5 times the amount of doses Moderna plans to make, right? It also made a deal with the European Commission, right, which is a branch of the EU, to supply 200 million doses of this vaccine, and Pfizer plans to deliver 1.3 billion, right, billion doses by the end of the following year, which is 2021. I'm not sure about you guys, but when the vaccine is available, I would most definitely get it, and you probably should too, right? Both vaccines require 2 separate shots that you needed to get within, I believe, a few weeks from each other, right? A time from each other. So the vaccine's coming, guys, right? And this has been a quite historical moment for the scientific community. This is the fastest ever a vaccine has been created. And not only this, but the efficacy is just stellar, right? It's incredibly good. You typically don't get such an efficacy this high even on a vaccine that takes like the normal, 10 years and sometimes more to develop. I mean, assuming everything goes well, this will be one of the greatest feats of the scientific community, creating a vaccine so effective in record time for the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, really, hats off to the scientific community. I mean, awesome, right? That was upbeat. Now let's get into something that's a little less upbeat, right? The economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic that has not been so good, to say the least. Okay, first I'll give a disclaimer. I am not an economist, nor have I taken any economics course in school, but I do watch CNBC and Yahoo Finance Live, and you know, read the Yahoo Finance articles. So like, I guess I know a thing or two about the world of economics and finance, and by that I mean literally one or two things. So please don't just take what I say with a grain of salt. Take what I say with a solid 20-pound block of salt directly mined from the Himalayas or wherever salt is mined. Not exactly sure, the sea. Well, then you'd evaporate it from the sea. Or the desert, right? There's salt deposits in the desert. Oh well. If you look at the unemployment chart, you'll see a steady decline in the unemployment from like 2008, which was the peak of the housing bubble, and then just like a constant slope down, a steady decrease in unemployment until the beginning of 2020, and then there's a massive uptick, and then within a few months there has been a pullback in the amount of unemployment. So now we're at around 7% unemployment, which is by historical standards really high, but it's still below the peak of almost 15%. So you might think this would be horrible for the financial market. I mean, you're only half right, but if it weren't for the Federal Reserve providing counter-cyclical monetary policy, which in this time of economic ruin means easing monetary policy, which if it did not happen, both the economy and financial markets would be in bad shape. But the financial markets are doing all right because of this sort of quantitative easing. So to give you guys a sense of how this affects the financial markets, the NASDAQ is up 20% from its all-time highs pre-pandemic, and the S&P up 5% from pre-pandemic highs, and the Dow is at around its pre-pandemic all-time highs. I mean, so this is great news for your parents' retirement brokerage accounts, but why have the financial markets recovered as if the pandemic never happened, but the real economy is still feeling the effects of this pandemic? So first of all, because of the looser monetary policy, money is easier to borrow. By lowering rates to near zero, the Fed incentivizes banks to not keep money in the Federal Reserve as part of their Federal Reserve requirement, and instead, now they have a bunch of money. I mean, they're not going to let it sit there. They're going to lend it to businesses. So there's an influx of supply of more money, which causes more money to be floating around. It's more money to be borrowed, which makes the money more affordable to borrow. And businesses can afford to borrow money to keep themselves afloat. So that's pretty nice, right? This is an example of a quantitative easing in action. But the Fed also has done other things, like the Fed has restricted banks from any stock buyback, so the banks can't buy back stocks, they can't raise dividends, which means they can't pay out all their shareholders in any way. They can only take this money, and they're not gonna keep it in the Fed because they're yielding nothing, or they're not going to just sit on this cash because inflation is gonna eat it up. So guess what? They're going to lend it to more people, or the theory is that they'll lend it to more people, which is true, right? It is happening. Not only this, but the Fed is short for Federal Reserve, is buying credit derivatives such as corporate bonds and I believe consumer debt such as credit card loans, car loans, etc. to help out the most hard hit company and just to help out financial markets to keep themselves afloat. The Federal Reserve also has instated the Main Street Lending Program, which allows businesses to apply for loans. Many people, you guys who think politics affects the economy by a lot, but it does, but I think the Federal Reserve does not get enough credit. It also helps keep the economy afloat and helps the economy equally as much as the government does. The economic fallout would have been much worse without the Federal Reserve. And Jerome Powell, the head of the Fed, actually does a thing for the US economy. So not only this, but this whole called a fiasco has been a great example of Keynesian economics in action. You might have heard that quarter two GDP growth was negative 33% annualized, but quarter three shot back right up 33%. That doesn't mean we completely recovered, but because of how percentages work, because of negative 33% times plus 33%, or if you add that on to plus 33%, you get 100 minus 33 is 67%, and then if you add back up 33%, you don't get back to 100, you get back to 89%, which is not 100, but that's a lot better than negative growth for the first, second, and third quarter. Instead, we got a negative growth for the first, second quarters, but the third quarter, we got a positive GDP growth, so that's a good thing. It looks like the economy is recovering, or at least there has been a reversal in the trend. All this happened because of a Keynesian counter-cyclical stimulus that happened to prevent things from getting any worse than they could have. You might have noticed that earlier I said that the NASDAQ has risen way more than the Dow from the late February peak, right? This is because the NASDAQ is weighted on the performance of the top 100 most innovative stocks, which is mostly tech companies that have done extraordinarily well during the course of the pandemic because of an increased reliance on tech. So in the NASDAQ, there's Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Tesla. And these companies account for half the entire index. Well, slightly less than half, but still, that's a lot. And all of these companies have done incredibly well despite the pandemic. However, the Dow, which has only broken even from its pre-pandemic highs, contains a lot of consumer defensive names, and it's not as tech-heavy as the NASDAQ. And because of this, it has done less well than the tech-heavy NASDAQ over the course of these few months. And because of Fed and technology holding the economy together, the financial markets are pricing in and acting accordingly. And after all, it sees and is predicting the light at the end of the tunnel while the economy recovers and everybody gets vaccinated. Hopefully the financial markets are right. And that's all I have for today. Thank you for tuning in to Juan's segment of the T of HP podcast. And have a great day, or have a great rest of your day.
Highland Park DECA presents Decrypt It, a virtual escape room. Sign up at http://hp.booktix.com/ to play detective to figure out the clues and help a child find something you never want to lose. Time slots are available for December 18th from 7 to 9 p.m., December 19th from 5 to 8 p.m., and December 20th from 1 to 4 p.m. Ticket prices are as follows: group of 2 for $30, group of 4 for $50, group of 6 for $70, and group of 8 for $90. Enter promo code T of HP all caps to get a 10% off discount. All proceeds benefit the Chaotic Spider Foundation. Sign up by December 16th.